This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We all know that medicine has changed radically in the past century. But one thing we tend not to think about too much is how much our definitions of illness itself have changed. Addiction used to be considered a matter of weak will. Now it's recognized as a disease. Autism used to be considered a rare condition, and now there's a wide spectrum of disorders. Cancer used to be one disease, and now there are subtypes of breast cancer. My next guest says we need to be paying a lot more attention to how our definitions of disease are changing and what that might mean for both research and treatment. Dr. Art Kaplan is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor and founding head of the Division of Biomedical Ethics at New York University School of Medicine in New York. Art, welcome as always.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's go back to the very beginning, a very good place to start, as they say. How was disease, I mean, this word, dis-ease, it just kind of sounds like something wrong. How was it defined originally?
Originally, it was driven by symptoms. Symptoms made diseases. Fever. Nobody distinguished the causes of fever. They just said you had the disease of fever. People said, oh, you have disorders of the bile, if you had indigestion or diarrhea or stomach troubles, that sort of thing. So very crude and kind of by your complaints. If you didn't complain, you didn't have a disease. We would call that today illnesses, not diseases. The symptoms, the manifestations of something, that's what used to be the disease categories. And so you reported it, you were the definition of what was considered a disease. It was the patient and their symptoms.
You kind of differentiated there between illness and disease. Is there a technical difference?
There is. So in the 20th century, as people began to look through microscopes and surgeons began to have anesthesia and they could look inside the body without having people screaming their brains out and jumping out of the surgical theater, they began to see that different illnesses or sets of symptoms were correlating with different underlying, let's call them physiological or biological properties. So rabies, somebody realized, Louis Pasteur, that, you know what, we see all these symptoms and they lead to death, but if I look through my microscope, I can start to see certain microbes that seem to be associated with this disease. Same for syphilis. I can start to detect things because I have these new tools. So instead of saying it's just an illness because somebody is frothing at the mouth or having fits or dies, I can now say the disease is these little bugs, these little microbes, what we think of as bacteria and viruses today, that are getting in their bodies and causing these problems.
We still have plenty of things that I think we recognize as diseases, though, where we don't necessarily understand all of the underlying causes. Where does that leave those kinds of diseases?
It leaves them controversial. So we've accepted, say, fibromyalgia, this idea of general pain, something to do with generalized muscle pain, but nobody can find an agent. Nobody can find a characteristic set of neurological patterns. And so, yeah, there are even medicines sold to treat that disorder, but it's still somewhat controversial as to whether that is a real disease. No one doubts that people have the symptoms, but do we really have a handle on what's going on? PTSD has a little bit of that. People suffer from psychological trauma, we know that, from combat or exposure to violence, but what's really going on in terms of their underlying biology, who's susceptible to getting that, we don't know. So again, people might say, well, I don't doubt that you have an illness, but I'm not sure we really know how to treat it or cure it, and I'm not sure we even want to pay somebody to try and do it because we're not really sure whether we understand the underlying mechanism.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with bioethicist Art Kaplan of the New York University Center on Bioethics, and we're talking about the changing ways that we define diseases. You wrote this piece recently in Leaps magazine saying that we are in the midst of a revolution in terms of the way that we define disease. So what is that revolution that's taking place right now?
So the first revolution was classifying our symptoms into illnesses. That lasted about, 2,000 years, 1,900 years. It's sort of going back to Hippocrates. The second revolution is starting to realize there are microbes that cause disease. There are underlying changes in our physiology that cause disease, say our arteries getting clogged up and getting a heart attack. We understand all that. But the current revolution is genetic and molecular. What we're starting to see is things that we thought were the underlying causes of disease that helped us lump them together really aren't. So let me give you an example. When Angelina Jolie found out that she had breast cancer, she was tested and she saw that she had a genetic form. It's called BRCA1 and 2, a mutation in a gene that was probably causing her to get this breast cancer. And then she had her breasts removed, but later she had her ovaries removed because it turns out that that little error in her genes that can now be seen also causes ovarian cancer, and she didn't want to get that, so she did that prophylactically. In the case of those cancers, we'd always treat breast cancer and ovarian cancer as separate diseases. But now, because we're starting to see the genes and see the chemicals that they produce, we're starting to lump together some diseases like breast cancer and ovarian cancer. It wouldn't surprise me in 10 more years if we said, you don't have breast cancer, you have BRCA1 and 2 mutation disease, and that could cause cancer in your breast or in your ovaries. And at the far extreme, consider this. It may be that somebody suffers from, let's say, headaches. They also may suffer from something like Crohn's disease, a stomach disorder. We're starting to understand now that you could have the same chemicals produced in your body because of a genetic defect that bring about the headaches, the migraines, or Crohn's disease. Who would have stuck those two diseases together? But if you want to do research on them, then maybe what you need to do is to recruit people with migraines and with Crohn's disease and put them in the same study, because the treatment you have is going to go after the chemical that's causing very different things to happen in different parts of the body, but has a common cause.
Hey, listening to you right now as a patient, I'm thinking to myself, okay, we're understanding the roots of different diseases or symptoms or health problems or whatever you want to call them much better, and that gives us potential pathways to better treatments. I don't particularly care what you call my disease if you have a way to treat it. So is this whole revolution in how we define disease, is this just an academic and philosophical exercise, or is there a place where the rubber meets the road and it really matters what we call a disease?
Yeah, it will matter to the patient in a couple of ways. First, it may turn out that you're not going to take certain medicines. You may hear that your friend has, let's say, the flu. And you think, well, I want to take medicine for the flu, but somebody's going to come along and say, you have flu type A. Your buddy has flu type B. The medicine we have is only good for flu type B. Don't even bother. It's not going to help you. Whereas before, you might have said, I have the flu. I'm going to take an antiviral drug. So you may find yourself with either more precise choices or wondering why, how come they're getting it and I'm not? A second way in which it could happen is you could be recruited into studies. Normally you'd think, well, I found out I got early stage prostate cancer. I'm going to go to the doctor and they're going to offer me to be in a trial or a study of prostate cancer drugs. And you look around and in the room with you are people who have, I'm making this up, asthma. And you think, what the heck is going on? Why are they in the same study as me? It's because the pathway is common. And we'll find ourselves a little bit surprised down the road to see all kinds of different groups going together. That also means that fundraising will change, right? So I might have raised money and said, hey, let's raise money for lung disease. But all of a sudden, a lot of the diseases have common roots with people who have different kinds of cancers. And so we're going to recalibrate our organizations. It won't be the Lung Association or the Cancer Association. All of a sudden, we'll now be asking for contributions to genetic disease 29, and people will have to sort of evolve and start to understand, hey, what we thought of as having a group identity or diseases common to different people, we're going to rethink that.
I'm talking with bioethicist Art Kaplan of New York University. Let's dig into that funding issue a little bit more, because we already hear about issues trying to find funding for rare diseases because, of course, you don't have the large community and the large societal benefit if you're, you know, curing cancer and curing millions of people as opposed to curing 5,000 people with a rare disease. It's a lot harder to raise funds. So what does this shifting way of defining diseases, of lumping some together and pulling some out, what does that mean in terms of getting funding? You were already hinting at that a little bit. And does it suggest that we need to perhaps change the way that we fund disease research to match the new ways that we're defining diseases?
I think that's a great question. And I think the answer is we have to rethink, because more and more of us are going to find ourselves in subtypes, maybe not with the same problem as we used to think of as our fellow sufferers of Parkinsonism or somebody who had rheumatoid arthritis. Now, there's all kinds of new subtypes of those diseases, and individuals might benefit from certain drugs, that's great, or certain lifestyle changes, but others won't. And so they're not your allies as much anymore. Our fundraising now is oriented toward disease categories, the old school 20th century ways in which we divided up the world. That's not going to work in the 21st century. So we may need to form sort of group organizations. There's something called the National Organization of Rare Diseases, where they fundraise for a bunch of things together, even though they may be very different subgroups. I think you're also going to find the bigger disease groups, cancer, lung, National Association of Mental Illness, they may have to rethink how they're making their appeals, because some subgroups within those disease categories are not going to be able to follow the same cures as other people will. Good news is, I think we're going to get more cures and better outcomes as we begin to split these broad disease definitions apart. Bad news is they make more of us, if you will, orphans or in smaller groups.
What does this mean for diseases that are not genetically caused, or at least not solely genetically caused?
Yeah.
I mean, we're understanding more and more about the interactions between the genes that we carry and our lifestyle choices, the environment we live in. Is that being incorporated into this new understanding and these new definitions of disease?
Well, slower. For example, in diabetes, we know that eating too much is the cause of a lot of diabetes, and you don't need to get into the genetics. But it may be that by varying our microbiome, the little microbes that live inside our bodies and help us digest food and excrete things, that we could start to either speed that up or otherwise alter it so that digestion worked more efficiently, or maybe that certain foods would just pass through us more easily and we wouldn't absorb them and get fat. So I can imagine both lifestyle change still being at the core of diabetes management, the less you eat, less likely you're going to get that disease. But at the same time, some of our cures, they're not going to be just insulin management. They may actually be trying to change this little microbial environment that kind of is our digestive system. We never thought of it that way. We think our stomach digests our food, but it's actually the little bugs that live in our stomach that digest our food. And so that opens up complementary pathways, if you will, that go along with lifestyle. So we don't want to forget about the environment. Obviously, air pollution causes a lot of asthma. It's not just our biology. Clearly, our lifestyles can drive our weight and our risk for many weight-related diseases. But still, we may find ourselves able to tweak at the, if you will, microbial level, at the molecular level, in ways that your father's doctor didn't think about.
It's going to be a very different world, and it sounds like we all maybe need a biology refresher course before we go to the doctor next time.
I think that's going to happen, and I think our children will start talking to us about diseases where some of the parents are thinking, what the heck was that? What are they talking about? Whatever happened to the flu? Or why don't we talk anymore about asthma? What happened to those things? But, you know, it's very good in terms of progress. These are advances that really let us, if you will, the same shock that 20th century scientists had when they looked through the microscope and found microbes and realized they're causing diseases, not bad air or foul odors or something. That's what's happening in this century as people peer behind the changes in your liver, behind the changes that you see happening in your skin and start to say, you know what, those are bad chemicals produced by certain genes. It's the same kind of amazement that I think is driving this latest revolution. So they're always, you know, it rocks the boat when those things happen, but I think very much to the good.
Dr. Art Kaplan is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine. Art, thanks so much.
Hey, my pleasure.
Up next, big questions about artificial intelligence and the future of the environment. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.